This is the concluding session of the 20th Anniversary Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on behalf of the delegates to the 1955 conference, together with other conference members, from the service agencies of the General Service Board, we welcome you. I should like myself to take this opportunity of extending a tremendous debt of gratitude to all who have worked with us in making this convention the success that we hope you think it has all been. And as the opening session starts, I have a very great pleasure to introduce a man who has given so very much, not of his time necessarily, there has been much of that, but who has given so much of his heart to all of us. He is not an alcoholic, but we love him so very dearly. And so, I should like to introduce to you the Chairman of the Board of Trustees of your General Service Board, who will discuss for us some material which he has entitled The Paradoxes of AA. And with that remark, I'm very happy. Look at this. I have completely messed up everything. I had them before me and I didn't put them on. This convention is more of a success than perhaps anyone has thought it ever could be. What, of course, should be the introduction? Just Bill. Above us, we see a banner. And that banner shows a circle, which is AA circumscribing the world. And within it is a triangle. And the base of the triangle, and the recovery on which we stand, the left of the triangle symbolizes our unity, and the right of the triangle, our arm of service. Such is the symbol of AA. I first saw it in Norway in 1950. But this symbol is not new with us. We have attributed this particular significance to it. But in actuality, its significance is very old. Students of ancient days tell me that centuries ago, it was regarded by priests and witch doctors alike as the symbol by which evil spirits could be kept away. And may that symbol ever stand guard over the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous.
We have already considered what the essence of our recovery has been. We have turned back the pages of history and watched the various channels of influence and of help coming through so many to form this confluence, which is AA. Last night we told of our frantic experience in trying to learn to work and to live together and to relate ourselves in harmony with the world about us. Today, our topic has to do with service, with the 12th step in all its implications. It is not odd to us of AA that the AA book long ago said, with us, action is the magic word. So this is our inheritance, the legacies of recovery, of unity, and service, which we now see in their main outline. I think there has been some confusion as to what the third legacy of service really consists. Of course, its great essential is carrying this message to the other alcoholic. But the moment we begin to carry the message, something else is involved. For example, when it occurred to my dear sponsor, Ebby, that he wanted to come over to Brooklyn and see me, he was at the time in New York. So, he had to drop a nickel in the subway turnstile to reach me. Otherwise, his good intentions would have been in vain. Something had to be done, something had to be paid to make his 12-step work possible. So it was, in those many meetings in that first summer in Memphis, we gathered in Anderson's living room. There was shelter over our heads, the hospitality of a home. I had no doubt the drunk cigarettes burned up a carpet, and the coffee bill was pretty hot. But that shelter and that coffee, even those cigarettes, if I may say so, no doubt facilitated carrying this message one to another. And I can't forget T. Henry and Clarissa Williams, non-alcoholics, whose home was thrown wide open to us strange people. They were strict church folks. I think from their point of view, we were a little uncouth. Our language was not always of the most desirable. But they forgot all about that and spared the enterprise. And they spent a good deal on food. And they brought in chairs from the local undertaker when the house began to fill up. And I make no doubt we burned their carpet. So there was a cost each time this message was carried. Well, after a while, homes got too small. We had to move in the hall. And we can all smile as we think of the great cries that went up from us drunks when landlords actually had the nerve to charge us money for those homes. The little thing, why, we said to the landlords, we can't mix money with spirituality. The landlord said, well, that's all right for me, but you don't get the hall. Then it cost a little something, and we began to drop money in the hat. Then when the egg grew very, very thick in an area, and it was just a great sprawling anarchy, sometimes benign and sometimes not so benign, and there was no head or tail of things at all, simplicity had been carried too far. Simplicity was getting complicated. So we had to organize some sort of service so that the area could function. And this consisted of getting somehow a committee out of this mass of alcoholics, a very painful process, who in turn would hire a little cubicle of an office and usually sat therein a very frightened little AA girl who was promptly told she was professionalizing AA by taking our telephone calls and relating us to the hospitals and listening to the complaints of the alcoholics. So, the third legacy really involved everything inside or outside of AA that legitimately helps it to function. For example, when St. Thomas Hospital in Akron threw itself open to us, took Dr. Bob on its staff, an indispensable aid to recovery. You know the work that he and Sister Ignatia did there. 5,000 alcoholics treated. And when they were through, there were a lot of bills of limit paid. The area made up the deficit. And the drunks who could pay for hospitalization did so. It cost something to get within reach of the 12th step. Same thing out in Knickerbocker Hospital. Dr. Stilforth and that beloved red-headed nurse, Teddy, processed 10,000 drunks. Well, there was a hospital involved, there was medical service involved, and a little dog, and another group of them. So we have found that while AA is never to be organized in the sense of being governed, and while each of us has more freedom than there is in any society on earth, if we are to carry the message, we must organize services to the extent that they will work. We have to organize the services to a certain degree to keep our way simple, because an anarchy is a very complicated thing. Now, we have directly inherited from Francis of Assisi a tradition of corporate poverty. We say that this movement should be as poor as it can be. But after all, even a poor man must eat, be fed, or else the blood ceases to flow through his arteries. Now then, only three times in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous have we had to indulge in prophecy. Nearly every development in our society has come as a result of an infinite and painful experience. But on three occasions, we have had to depart from this. We have had to anticipate a need that might come. The first anticipation was the AA book. Everybody said at the time, what do we need a book for? Our friends, helping Dr. Bob and me establish a center down there in New York, the Board of Trustees, what do we need these people for? And again, when we sought to link that Board of Trustees to AA as a whole, so that it could belong to you, what need of that? Well, the prophecy on the AA book made good, and I'm sure that any who have benefited by the services of our trustees know that that one has come true. And now we have been conducting a four-year experiment to see whether our board of trustees, who maintain services for the whole world, can be successfully linked to you, and whether you will take responsibility for assuming that they do their duty and giving them a cross-section of their opinion at all times. And can this conference, now sitting on this stage, be trusted to become the guardian of the AA tradition, the perpetuator of these priceless services, and the succession to the old-timers and the founders of AA? That is the sole venture and prophecy upon which we are now to embark. Now let me take you back to Dr. Bob's living room. As was observed last night, it was a long way from Dr. Bob's living room to the Jesuit and the Hindu and the cow. It took a lot of unity, and it took real life blood, the grace of God coursing in our world arteries, to make that letter from India possible. We sat there on that day, and we said to ourselves, what shall we do? So Bob suggested, well, let's call a meeting down at T. Henry. So we called the meeting. I think there were 18 there. At that time, Smith and Wilson were very hungry, particularly the Wilsons. I had some visions of earning a good living, being an AA. The Cleveland groups hadn't yet proved we could grow in size, so we thought we needed some paid missionaries. But above all, it seemed we needed a literature, so this thing wouldn't run off the track, so the message couldn't be garbled, so my experience could be presented to the AA of the district. And Dr. Bob and I agreed upon those things, and we presented them to the meeting. Well, the meeting was beset by the same fears that we now have in some quarters of this conference. At least 8 of those present said, no, let's not change anything. Let's not get into professionalism. We're going to quarrel over what goes into this book. Let's keep AA simple, said 8 of them. But then we advanced the same argument, we promoters. We said, but if you try to get it as simple as that, it won't get anywhere. The message will get garbled, we'll be ridiculed, it'll get more complicated. So by the narrowest of margins, when the vote came, that little group decided that I ought to go back to New York and raise money. Wasn't much money in Akron, but there was plenty in New York. For paid missionaries, probably a chain of hospitals out of which we could make a lot of money, and certainly some kind of a book or pamphlet about our operation. Well, you know, I spent years down Wall Street and feeling now that we had the answer for alcoholism, why, raising money like this, for this thing would be like shooting fish in barrels. So we tried a number of rich people, there wasn't any result, tried and tried. We had some other high-pressure salesmen around New York, we tried and tried, absolutely nothing happened. I began to be very disconsolate. I remember Lois was still in the department store. And one day I was in my brother-in-law's office. Leonard Strong, he was a physician. I was bellyaching how stingy the rich were on this matter of money for this new development that doubtless would sweep the world. Well, he'd heard a lot of this before, and somewhat wearily he said, well, when I was in high school, I used to know a girl, and I think that girl had an uncle, and it seems to me his name was Richardson, and if my memory shows me right, he has something to do with John D. Rockefeller's charity. I think he must be connected to the Rockefeller family. I believe he'd remember me if he's still alive. On the slender thread of recollection hung much of the destiny of Alcoholics Anonymous. Said he, shall I call him up? Oh, boy, yes. He called up the voice of dear old Willard Richardson. Now, down from my son years, came on the wire and he said, why, hello, Leonard. Where are you, Willard? Where have you been all these years? I'd like to see you. So my brother-in-law said, well, I have a relative here and there's been some success with alcoholics. Could we come over and talk to you? And lo and behold, we go over to Rockefeller Center, right up to Mr. John D. Rockefeller's private offices, in the front door, and soon we're sitting next to one of the greatest friends that family ever had. They'll tell you so themselves. Well, now for promoter, this is really getting hot, you know. This kindly but shrewd old man listened to the story. He immediately said, well, shouldn't we have another meeting? By all means, I had lunch with him. And then came the momentous meeting, which actually took place in Mr. John D. Rockefeller's private dorm room. It consisted of Dr. Silkworth and Doc Smith from Akron and a couple of drunks from out there and some of the New York contingent. And by this time, we'd acquired some new friends, friends of Mr. Richardson. There was also present Mr. Leroy Chipman, who later became one of the trustees, and our beloved Frank Amos, who was still on the board. I was told soon after I came into Mr. Rockefeller's boardroom that I was seated in a chair that Mr. Rockefeller had just vacated. Well, now for a promoter, that was really getting things hot. Nothing to it. Upshot of the evening was we tell our story. Mr. Scott of the Riverside Church, prominent New York engineering firm, was there too. And after we told our tales, this terrible question again arose. Won't money spoil this thing? Won't professionalism spoil? Won't big property ownership cause quarrels? Isn't it true that the great power of this thing is the carrying of the message, the kind of giving that demands no reward? The carrying of the good news, one to the other. Yes, we admitted that it was. But we'd only been able to carry it up to that time to about 40 people in 3 years. And now we had an answer. Well, they became convinced. They really thought we needed some money and probably quite a lot of it. Frank Amos was sent out to Akron. He looked over that situation, came back with a very enthusiastic report. We sent him out there because Smithy was hardest up for the minute. They were going to foreclose the mortgage on the house. Also, because it was the first growth and the best community sort of a deal. Although, of course, by then a group had started in New York. Frank came back with this glowing report, laid it before Mr. Richardson. Mr. Richardson made a digest, went in and placed it before Mr. John D. Rockefeller. Again, Providence, in the person of John D. Rockefeller, determined the destiny of this society. He has since told me and others that he was never so affected or moved by a story. That Alcoholics Anonymous crossing its life, his life was one of its signal events. And yet he turned to his old friend Willard and he said, but Willard, you will spoil this thing. Mr. Richardson wasn't quite so sure. And finally Mr. Rockefeller said, well, tell you what I'll do. I'll put a few dollars in treasury of the Riverside Church. Maybe it can help these two men, Dr. Bob and Bill, as you call them, along for a little bit. But please, Nick, money will spoil this thing. Don't ask me for any more. So $5,000 was put in the treasury of the Riverside Church, and Bob and I were eased through the year of 1938 by it, and the mortgage was lifted off the Smith Mortgage. We were a very long way from hospital chains, paid missionaries and books. Thank God. Perhaps unknowing, John D. Rockefeller had set us in the traditional branches of corporate poverty. He really saved us from the perils of property ownership and professionalism. Good for other societies, but very bad for us. Well, we alcoholics still persisted with our new friends. In spite of what Mr. Rockefeller said, we again deserted them as we needed large sums of money. And it was thought that we could form some kind of a foundation out of this informal committee and have a board of trustees and get it incorporated so that the rich could pour in a slew of dough, all tax-free. You know, do a service to the rich at the same time. We were actually supplied with lists of prospects, some very notable names on it, men of great wealth. And some of us promoter folks began to solicit money for the foundation all through the summer of 1938, and told God we didn't raise one damn cent. But it was pretty discouraging at the time. Early in the summer, this is 38, I had drafted what are now the first two chapters of the AA book. Indeed, we used those rough drafts as a part of the prospectus to persuade the rich to part from their money. So our great ambitions for prestige and wealth and missionaries and hospital chains by now are collapsed. But of one thing we were sure. We had to put the record of this thing into some kind of a book. And the foundation didn't have any money to support us while we prepared the book. And by this time we were having trustee meetings, and our new friends commiserated with us at each meeting. Guess we had one every month then for this lack of money. And finally, dear old Frank Amos said, well, Bill, why don't you take these two chapters down to Harper's? I know the religious editor down there, Gene Exton, and see what they would like to do about it. I took them in, and to my great delight, Mr. Exton said, well, this is very interesting. Mr. Wilson, could you finish a book written in this style? I wasn't too confident, thought I was lying violently, and said, oh, yes, of course, of course. Never written anything before in my life. Well, he said, in that case, I could advance you $1,500 in royalties. By this time, $1,500 looked like an immense sum of money. And I came back very excited. And then my spirits fell as people began to remonstrate. They said, yes, Harper's is a wonderful publishing firm, but there are two bugs in this proposition. If you eat up the whole $1,500 in royalties while the book is being prepared, and a lot of inquiries come in afterward as a result of publicity, how are we going to pay for them? Eating up the royalties in advance. And then there's a still worse bug in the thing. If this book proves to be a textbook for our society, why should it be in the possession of any publisher, however good? So then we got the insane idea of publishing the AA book ourselves. And thereby hangs a screaming tale. No fool. I had by this time a super promoter he could put rings around me, even though I'd been in Wall Street. And over the objection of the Board of Trustees and everybody else we knew, he and I went to a stationery store and we bought a pad of stock certificates and we marked on them $25, par value, Works Publishing Company. We never bothered to incorporate the company. We just typewrote on the certificate. So then we tried to cover the certificates to the alcoholics and their friends around New York. Well, we just got a terrific horse laugh. What did they say? Buy stock in a book not yet written? And we couldn't cover a share. Well, we figured that we had to appeal a little more to the profit-making instinct in the alcoholic. So we went up to the Reader's Digest. We said to the managing editor, well, now here is a budding society, here's the story, here are our fine connections, Mr. Rockefeller, Dr. Frozick, and all these nice people. It's a real good idea. Would you like to send a piece about it? And the managing editor, then Kenneth Payne, said, why, certainly, this is right up the Digest alley. And then we said, well, now we're preparing a book. It'll be out next spring, we hope. And about next spring, could we get an article in the Reader's Digest just mentioning this book? You wouldn't mind putting something in about it. No, that would be fine. I thought that would be just what the Digest would like. We rushed back to the Bronx and said, look, this thing is a finish. In those days, printing costs were very low. We paid no attention to the other publishing costs, and we said to the drunks, now look, how are you going to make it? Humphrey says this is going to be a good book. We can sell this book for $3.50, and it's only going to cost us 25 cents to print it. Now, if the Reader's Digest, with a 12 million circulation, tells about this book, they're just going to go out in carloads and, well, this stock of yours will be worth, well, you know, maybe millions, you can't tell. So a trickle of money started to come in from the stockholders, which began to feed the Wilson household and my old friend Hank's household, and we hired a little gal known and beloved to us old-timers, some of you here will remember her, Ruth Hawk. And I began to slowly dictate the chapters of the book to her. But I soon found I was no author. I was only an umpire. I shipped the chapters to Akron. We shipped them to New York. We discussed them in the New York meetings. And the balls over what was to go into that book were something terrific. There is a sort of an illusion around among the AAs that, you know, there must have been deacons with bright, bright robes and all with peace and serenity. Boy, the hassles over that book were something terrific. And they were especially bad the night the 12 steps were written. Because the drinks weren't getting up any money on the Works Publishing stock and the lager was running low, and I was having an imaginary ulcer attack, and we got a few chapters done, and we figured we got to put a backbone into this book of some sort, and I kind of thought we had to take these 6 steps in Ebbie's formula and blow them up so they'd be a little more concise and so the drunks couldn't wiggle out anywhere between. And about that time, a couple of guys came in with some awful gripes, and I was sick of bed, and I was real mad all over. So I guess it must have been an inspired job, but not by me. At any rate, those 12 steps were drafted in about 30 minutes, I guess. Afterward, the hassling introduced a couple of other ideas, lifesavers. One idea was God as you understand it. I didn't have that in there. I was still suffering from that sudden spiritual experience of mine. So that was introduced by discussion. And then I felt that the drunks really ought to be humbled. And there was one phrase which said that we were going to give our lives to God on our knees. And the drunk said, you take this knee business out of there, which we did. Well, finally, the book is done. We make a pre-publication copy of it. We ship it around to everybody, psychiatrists, doctors, clergymen, Catholic Committee on Publications, New York, went through there like a breeze. They said, why, this is swell. Just got to make one change. At the end of your story, Bill, you say that we found heaven right here on this good old earth. You can't have it that way. We're promising the folks something much better later on. Can't you change that to utopia? So everything is all set for the big kill, and the stockholders are waiting for the money to come in. And we go up to Cornwall Press, and they say, well, here we are. We're all ready to go. Well, how many books do you want? Oh, we'll just print a few to start with, say 5,000. At that time, there were only 100 AA members, and there were 28 stories, and they were all going to get a book apiece. And there were 49 stockholders, and they were all going to get a book apiece. So there wasn't any market in AA. But after all, the Digest was going to print this piece. So we go over to dear old Edward Blackwood, just died. He wanted so desperately to be out here. President of the Cornwall Press. And by this time, the stockholders' money was pretty well petered out, and we had to shore it up by a loan from old Charlie Towns for $2,500. And oh boy, the going was getting tough. And I don't know what we gave. I guess we gave Mr. Blackwood $500 to print 5,000 copies or something like that. So the print order being in, my friend Hank and I went up to Reader's Digest. We got hold of Mr. Payne. Said we, well, Mr. Payne, we're all ready to shoot. Mr. Payne says, excuse me, shoot what? Who are you people anyway? Oh, he said, I remember you were the fellows in here last fall about that alcoholic enterprise. He said, you know, I'm awful sorry. I was dead sure the Digest would want to print that piece, but he said, when I talked with the editors, they said, nix on it. Too controversial. People don't care anything about this. And I should have let you know, but I completely forgot about it. By this time, we had the stockholders on the hook for $4,500, Charlie Towns for $2,500, 5,000 books in the warehouse, no place to go. And in that very month, the landlord pulled the pucker string on 182 Clinton Street, and Lois and I got set out in the street. That was the state of Alcoholics Anonymous in the spring of 39. And when we had to face up to those gunks who had been buying this stock on installments, $5 a month for 5 months, oh, well, we were almost frantic to get some publicity so we could move some books, so we could bring in some more alcoholics. We shopped around among the magazines. Old Bert Taylor hawked a business that afterward failed for $1,000 to get us by the summer. And in the fall, Totenhauser, then editor of Liberty, printed a piece called Alcoholics and God. And that brought in 800 inquiries. And, of course, the entire proceeds of those book sales went to keep little Ruth eating. Meanwhile, we've been giving her worthless publishing stock as a salary ever since last spring. So she kept on typing away. She was a non-alcoholic who stuck. Well, we do get some publicity. There was one big flop I skipped, though, before we got to the Liberty piece. As I told you, my friend in this enterprise, my dead poor soul, I've got an idea. We just got a fellow out of an asylum up here by the name of Ryan, and I think that he knows Gabriel here. So we got a hold of Ryan. Yeah, they said, I know Gabriel. Used to be in the ad business myself. He'll remember me. So over he goes to Heater and comes back with the glad news. Oh, boy. He will put us on that heartthrob three-minute program he used to have. Yes, Peter will do it. He's going to interview me on the radio. Said my promoter friend, we got to get out a little advanced publicity. So we scraped up another $500, the last soon. And my friend put it into a shower of postal cards, which went to every doctor east of the Mississippi River, saying, Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure Cure for Alcoholism, buy the big book, 350. Listen to an AA member on the heater program. $500. Well, he had it so hot on that we could see book orders coming in by carload. However, we took an extra precaution. As I said, Ryan was just out of Rockland Asylum. And we had to be awful sure that Ryan would get there to that deadline. So with two guards, we actually locked him up in the downtown athletic club until he could be reached. And sure enough, the program came off. Ryan pulled out the tremolo stop. The drunks had got their ears glued to the radios. We could see book orders coming in, carloads of books going out. We couldn't wait for 3 or 4 days, hardly, before we went over to old box 658 B. And we looked in the box, and our hearts fell. Oh, boy. And Hank said very brightly, well, they couldn't put them all in the box. They must have meal bags for all that. So, we went to the window, and the clerk brought us exactly 12 postal cards. And we had exactly 2 orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and the rest was from doctors, mostly intoxicated, ribbing the dickens out of us. And our enterprise collapsed right on the way. But as I said, in the final of the Liberty Peace, in 1940, Mr. Richardson came into a trustees meeting with big news. We hadn't heard from Mr. Rockefeller since 1937. He said, Mr. Rockefeller takes no interest in this thing. Would like to give a dinner for Alcoholics Anonymous. Invite in some of his notable friends. Mr. Richardson produced an invitation list. When we looked at it, we were bug-eyed. It would add up to at least $1 billion in wealth. Well, we figured Mr. Rockefeller's changed his mind and money troubles were all over, nothing for it. So it was a big dinner at the Union Club. Mr. Rockefeller was sick that night, sent over Nelson. Harry Emerson Fawcett came and gave us a big plug. So did Dr. Foster Kennedy, the neurologist. And, of course, the drunks took their turn. This guy, Morgan, still sober out of the asylum, was there. And we planted the drunks around at the tables with the bankers to kind of indoctrinate them. One asked Morgan, well, Mr. Ryan, I suppose you're in the banking business. Oh, no, said Ryan, I'm just out of Rockland Asylum, but this area is wonderful. Well, at least the moment for the big touch had come. And you could see they were all softened up. But up gets Nelson Rockefeller, and he said, my father, so sorry he can't be here tonight. He is so glad that you people have seen the beginnings of this society of great promise. Few things more affecting than this have ever crossed my father's life. But, dear people, this is a thing that needs no money. It is the work of two good years. Whereupon a whole $1 billion got up and walked right straight up. Afterwards, Mr. Rockefeller wrote all that came to the dinner and all he didn't. A letter in which he said these same things, and down at the bottom of it, he remarked, I am giving Alcoholics Anonymous $1,000 as temporary aid, as something that should become self-supported. When the bankers got this letter, they each began to tot up, as John gives $1,000, how much does that make me? So one guy sent us $10. The highest contribution was $300, and each year we asked our dinner list to give us a list. From 1940 to 1945, it averaged about $1,500 a year, and that just barely eased slipping by. Excepting for that, we had to stand on our own feet, and in 1945, praise God, we were able to say to Mr. Rockefeller, we are self-supporting,
good contributions in taking care of their office, we all over the world take nothing away. Then in 1949 comes the Charity Coat case. And here was a veritable avalanche. Prior to this, the office, the little cubicle of Beezy Street near the post office box, had been supported just by the book. Nor had been asked for anything. But now in the book rush, we found that volunteers couldn't cope with it. So we came here, and we said, volunteer, using the dollar a member a year as a measuring stick, could you help us answer this mail? So thank God we answered the mail, 67,000 pieces of it, all with a nice person left. And the books began to slowly move. And we began to get lists of people in every town all over the country, sometimes in different countries. And we wrote them. And then out of the travel, out of the established routes, by then Akron, New York, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, out of established routes, we would give travel members lists of these prospects. And so it began its work. A thing you understand so well. But shucks, that was only the beginning. As soon as these AA groups began to form, all of those members began to pull back onto this office. And we began to retell to them the experience of the older groups. And it was in this period that the old tradition began to take form, finally published in 1945. The tradition couldn't have been ever thought of or published, I think, unless we'd had the focal point of that headquarters. Meanwhile, the stockholders of the book had been rather hurriedly bought out by a non-alcoholic friend and raised the money to do it. He got some off from Mr. Rockefeller, and some off from one of the boys and two of the dinner guests, and we paid all of the stockholders off at par. Now then, that naturally put Hank and me on the spot. We each had a piece of it too, you know. So we gave ours to the foundation, and that gave this board of trustees, then called the Alcoholics Foundation, the title to the book. So we began to own the trust for our whole society. Well, the Saturday Post piece catapulted us into national attention. So pretty soon we got a public relations problem. A big one and a delicate one. What attitude would we take toward medicine, toward religion? If we started to compete with the doctors, they'd be so. If they turned out to be another religion, why would we be in competition too? How are we going to relate ourselves to prisons? How are we going to relate ourselves to hospitals, to the general public? Was there to be any control of members who could jump up before microphones and represent us? And out of years of struggle, we achieved the public relations idea that our public relations should proceed by attraction rather than promotion. And one of the results of that is that we are at peace. Up until now, with the whole world. The whole world thinks well of us. Almost too well. I think our reputation is rather better than our character. But a sound public relations policy, well administered, is necessary to bring in the balance. Then problems just multiplied and multiplied. There were questions of translation. There was the question of a whole pamphlet literature. And little by little, your headquarters grew. All this time, under the guidance, on the board of trustees, consisting of some of these old friends and two white on the bus. And a group of the friends where names, books, and pamphlets are shipped in tons to them. A group of the friends where letters are written to the tune of thousands to them. And all kinds of stuff. And they're all parts of the world. Your office staff now consists of five gangs, part-time hands. Meanwhile, the good line had come along. That was started quite independently, but it took on nationally. It was attached to the foundation, but it was incorporated, but the foundation has its control and the good ones have gone nationally and internationally and became the current means of communication between us all. A sort of a magic carpet on which we can ride from place to place on the aerial surface. So the growth line is born, so is the service office. I wish I could detail for you just what that deal is like down there. You really have to see it to believe it. One of our services is to show visitors around. And since we opened uptown, no Grand Central, hundreds, if not thousands of AA boutiques have for the first time got a world vision of AA. AA functioning as a whole worldwide. By the time 1948 or 9 rolled around, well, another terrific problem had presented itself. A problem even more perilous than that of anonymity breaking, which you think in Trump means almost nothing. And the problem is this. Dr. Bob was falling ill, in all probability, mortally ill. Some of us woke up to the idea that a few of the girls in the office and he and I were the only ones for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. The trustees were completely unknown deals, inexpensive deals. They were normally responsible to you, and certainly they had lived up to all of that, but you couldn't hold them accountable. They were an independent body. They had your public relations, your money, your literature, your magazines, your books. They owned it all and trusted you. And here were just us few, a linkage. And one of the links was going to go out, Dr. Bob. So we knew that unless we could reach the trustees securely for the moment, when the bold trouble came, and the trustees made even one big blunder, and fortunately we have been spared from that all these years, then a collapse in the very center would be inevitable, and maybe that collapse could never be recouped, and it would mean the collapse of the world services that without question have accounted for half of the sky and much of the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. What would we do? Well, again, the same question was, let's keep it simple. Things are going along all right now. But some of us insisted and persisted. And when Dr. Bob came near to the day of his death in 1950, the terrible logic of it all was forced upon us. We must be linked to this society. And with Dr. Bob's permission, I stopped the country for the so-called Third Legacy Plan. The idea being that these world services are the heart of the Third Legacy. These services are the primary things that make good trust at work possible. And related to the world outside. So I sent the country to set up a conference of elected people who could meet yearly with these trustees. And the difference of it was, who could a whole state elect somebody and send them down in New York? We all shivered when we thought of the clubhouse and all of these balls we had on a much smaller scale. How could we do it? And then came this idea of no personal nominations in those assembly meetings. Two-thirds vote or one. The idea that the man was coming to New York not as a law girl for his area, not as a senator, but as a third in the world area. I never forget how I held my breath in Boston when we first tried it on. The Irish came, they looked at the plan. Before the meeting, one of them with a great political mind said, Bill, I got a hunch it's going to work, even here. They couldn't elect anybody by a majority vote or a two-thirds vote, and the whole Dominion Committee grew out to see who's going to know. So in came the delegates. The trustees made their report. We threw the whole place wide open. We adopted the principle that on 2/3 vote of the conference, the trustees would abide. The trustees and men and their successors would henceforth thereafter consult the conference. We have finished a four-year extended trial of this conference, and you must see it if you would believe it. The meaning is that all has gone from the level of politics into statesmanship in its principal state of affairs. I feel that the future of Alcoholics Anonymous in this conference is utterly safe, even to me. So I want to thank you for being the first conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I can do to mess this one up. I have been carefully repeating to myself at intervals for the past few minutes to take steps. Continue to take personal inventory and when wrong, promptly admit it. Along the way, I've come to like the flood that I pulled because now I can get real homey. And instead of Mr. Bernard Smith, I'm going to say our good friend Ian Smith, who now presented the book, The Paradoxes of AA. Ian. Wilson, members of the conference, members of the convention. These who have left your homes throughout North America to journey to St. Louis when they heat of the summer did not come in search of sobriety. For a fixing our purpose, we need not have to be here these last 3 days. That we will be here have drawn inspiration out of this great moment in the rich history of AA we cannot deny. But the fact is that we who are here have achieved sobriety, and the bonding found within AA will lead to forgiveness and with it a spirit of real healing. Even though the feelings here were materialistic ideals. The only reason you are not here for you to be in your society, but rather the keeping of your conscience of spirit to ensure that the structure of any idea that this weakness in your own life is rendered indestructible. But this time, as we feel our feeling is a sense of desire, to ensure that this feeling of your own survival is preserved for the survival of generations of alcoholics yet unborn. May not be threatened by what we do here and what we have done here. But if you fail, then that is the reason of the destruction of AA and leading to sobriety. Millions of people destined for alcoholism will never find the key that can unlock the door of their alcoholic drug changing. Just in one sense, we are here to ensure that our feeble-offered of individual events and experiential sickness that once racked your minds and your body, we need to be the kind of life Christians know. This is even the structure of OA today, as that we are in the name of the Christian Church. And still, by this generation of OA, the succeeding generations, that the great spiritual movement for attaining and maintaining sobriety is preserved for their youth and their liberation. There is no reason, however, why we here must be able to ensure that for all time the structure of AA never crumbles, nor its message is suspended. On the other hand, even if you perhaps more clearly than those of you to whom AA has become not only a way of life as it is for me, but in the first instance, a means of deliverance from the dread disease of alcoholism. Some of the key questions, brother, may be the message that the Bible that is increasing in most terms of faith for someone of which lifted up from the deceiving path that led to dissolution and destruction to the spiritually ascending one that led to sobriety. The real great laboratory of OA, as established as a basic truth to this material stage, that even the dreams of one decency, the vanity, the illusion of infection, was the true life. And that even though the materialistic idea of the sustained dreams of spirit is the illusory one, and the visible evidence of the spiritual and the unknown suffering of the deliverance is a truth we must reveal, so that a world of suffering for the spiritual ills that may not take on an alcoholic form may even have the living truth that a first deliver its desire as it has to you. One genuine privilege of being out in the air, although not in it. I have been spared the agonies of alcoholism, and yet during these years in which I have been permitted by your grace to serve as chairman of your general service board and of your annual service conferences, I have been the only one beautifully called non-alcoholic I've been to the intervening message of AA. And we need an understanding, I trust, of the depth of the suffering of the alcoholic and the principles of living which end the suffering and brought sobriety. And so, as we have heard, this afternoon we see the millions of many here assembled, but also the countless brothers and sisters who have been restored to life through AA, whose hearts are here in St. Louis, though 1,000 miles away. In keeping with this concept of service, I wish, in talking with you this afternoon, speaking to you for the mentality of the collective experience of all of OA as I see that experience. And so I see you doing the beginning of us who identify my remarks with any alcoholic who's been restored to life through OA rather than the word you, which did mean all the things of AA in the Sunday, the Sunday afternoon. In a short period of time, between the original life of which we live and for which we liberated, and the real life which we now live, there is found many kind of paradoxes. Take a simple statement, I am an alcoholic. In my civilization, an alcoholic is an individual. The one continuing to hold to itself, seeking to deliver the function effectively by teaching the accepted standards of the behavior. But we used to be bringing our brothers and our sisters in the field of conviction and the truth, I am an alcoholic, that time we will not listen to and do not God when we drink again. It is the first time in the world we have been to see the Lord of the House of Jesus, but he is the one who is drinking alcohol. So, when the time comes that we describe ourselves as alcoholics, the sign of Jesus is a benefit of such, and even as we are in this moment, we must admit that we have spent the right to describe ourselves as alcoholics. We live in the terms of the society from which we were liberated. And that society and the ways of our exclusive danger refer to us as alcoholics. We refuse to accept this description and definition. And yet we read to the first time that we accept the drink, crying out to ourselves and to the world of our world that we are alcoholics, that society seeks to define us as such. Some by the dictionary are being revised, some by time. But what the time is for us? For the time is the vision of the world to watch, and I'm going to drive, and not confident sense of an alcoholic. After all, I have even a smile for one and one small line in the dictionary. Yes, that great statement, I am an alcoholic, is a paradoxical one indeed, paradoxical because it is a great truth. Well, these occasions that a materialistic society can neither comprehend nor ever define. It is a truth I cannot leave with this simple observation. For all these years, I am an alcoholic, and the for a sick society. How can one not suffer the stresses and rights of the alcoholic, no matter who is to be one? How can one not see the blood coming against them when they live with alcohol, no matter who is to release it if they drink it when they are an alcoholic? What an uncertain morning that it was a time of defeat, we are with a triumph. A triumph of the spirit. A triumph of humility over false pride and self-centeredness. How few men believe, rather than the times to stand up before their neighbors and their own humility, saying, this is what I really am. Bound as much as a desire by the changes and signs, the materialistic but unfortunately socially accepted ideas, most of the time, in the picture we present of ourselves to that society in keeping with those ideals, when to acquire the ability to present the picture of ourselves to this society as we really are. And so, when we feel the conviction in the sense, I am an alcoholic, as a feeling in the nation of the original world in which our alcoholism is nurtured. And when we sit before our suffering brother as he stands the wounded man in the hummus, bound by the story of the suicidal Mary Lynch, our hands reach with a genuine meaning that our brother who is lost has been found again. He may sleep, he may falter, but nothing can take away from him, or for not, that moment of acceptance by him of himself, and acceptance of him by men and women who can talk of their own suffering and understand what it means for an alcoholic to stand before his brethren and say, I am an alcoholic. And the joy of this evening strengthens all of us, for he is our brother, and he has been returned to us, even as we have once been returned to our brothers and sisters. In a feeling in which the evidence of the word, I am an alcoholic, has great significance. The moment in which you are trapped is the moment when you are meeting the moment for the first time stands before an assembly of the brothers and says, I am an alcoholic. There is another railroad sign which is of perhaps greater significance. And that is the moment when we say to that man or woman who is our sponsor, in the darkness and desperation of our souls, I am an alcoholic. And this deep moment, when this statement is made, comes to a second paradox in a way. In order to speak of business, we accept as a principle of giving that we need a gift of labor, just in response to the superior social and financial position, and therefore because of his own strength, should help the weaker members of his community. We need to use the certain terms and reasons of political and business life, visiting hospitals and homes to cheer and help the sick and the enfeebled. When it is time to use women and men to liberate a piece of the concept of help thy neighbor, if this is used as a social and financially strong, human beings, secure people, organizing philanthropic movements to help the weak and the afflicted. Now do not describe these socially accepted concepts of help thy neighbor. But the paradox of the union is that we do not see our people and alcoholic brothers from the superiority and strength of our position, but from the realization of our own weakness. We talk to the union about strength and about weakness. We believe that the only thing we people are even if we are suffering now. We do not boast of our strength and overcome the alcoholism, but speak of our great weakness in being unable to conquer it. We can't come from being healed, but if I'm misguided, we were. We talk not of your shortcomings, but of those which were ours. We speak not in the judgment of what we did, but in judgment of what we once were. Are able to do so much in reaching them. We do not know, much like a little old bird that has just grown its wings and pokes its head through the shell that has been its world and looks for the first time at the freedom of the great blue skies in wonder. But the sky is wonder to behold still in terms of the instincts developed by the environment of the world of its shell which still encases it, and from which it is slowly emerging. And from the state of mind in which at the moment of contact our suffering brother says that he is an alcoholic, is thinking is still conditioned by the materialistic world which has contained him, and from which he is beginning to emerge. And so he believes, still believes, he is confessing to a social weakness, while we know that in the admission of his weakness lies the potent strength of humility and surrender. In that moment of contact, two lives are momentarily blended as we are filled with a sense of relief even as great as that of our suffering brother, who at that moment for the first time faces up to the reality of his existence and sloughs off the illusions by which he has lived. This acceptance of himself and our acceptance of him is indeed a great relief. And our emotion at that moment is one of relief with him, to be followed almost immediately by an independent type of emotion, a tremendous surge of joy, not for having given, but for having shared our suffering brother's spiritual relief. For when we sit with our alcoholic brother and deliver the message of the source of our recovery,
And if we can't subject to the suffering, we are living our own darkest experiences, even as we are living his. As we pray for his recovery, we pray for the maintenance of our own. But there is something more than a spiritual relief that flows from the acceptance of our suffering brother, of the reality of his existence and our acceptance of him for what he is. For in the days of our own suffering, we too could not accept life but rejected it. Our too had been a sense of hostility and a sense of the secret we thought we could drain away with alcohol. We too had lived in a fierce loneliness, filled with a sinking feeling of entrapment. Are you too have ceased resisting life and accepted it in terms of the very weakness that is to provide us with the strength to transform our individual world? We see him that made the contrast to days when we found acceptance within that society of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, followed by our 12-step work, provided us with the courage to face our lives to what these lives really were. Lives based upon the inventory of our truth now. That's the meaning of the truth. The anxieties and the terrors from which we formerly sent into the amnesia of alcohol. This meaning is with the chance of thinking by self-acceptance. And in that acceptance, the hatred of others and of ourselves disappears. And as our spirits remember our brother's spiritual readings, we are reminded of how the meaninglessness of life has disappeared for us, when with acceptance, life suddenly acquired meaning and real meaning for us. And as we talk in this moment of self-acceptance by our suffering brother, and can we use it to bring to the things of information that we have experienced? We unconsciously are demonstrating to society another great truth. And that is that we cannot rid ourselves of alcoholism any more than we can rid ourselves of any other social ills unless we really want to and are prepared to work towards the same. There is a third paradox in the world that stems directly from our 12th step. And you can use this thing to the true moment of contact with our suffering brother. All this we call the well-known, war-bound slogan, "Live for a Hope." You know the old paradoxically, that from your self statement, don't give it a hope. The way it's done that we can begin to invest our brain with that which we have, only in the experience of generous giving, a giving that is affecting with the world, a giving in which a sense of giving is understood as a sense of sacrifice, and sacrifice is simple. So we are finding there is no joy in the giving, and the sharing of a message which brought us our recovery removes the power to give. If there is any joy in the giving, the power to give, the opportunity of our suffering brother to accept that which we offer is irreparably lost. Society in returning to the alcoholic and turning to expression the enslavement of alcohol. This simply for us is true in a very special sense, paradoxical, if indeed it is true at all. And through the fact we will never be free from alcohol. Alcohol can be claimed as an excuse for us, for a minor improvement to the false ideals of a materialistic society. Our pride, our self-centeredness, and our jealousy, which increase with our insatiable rise to achieve these false ideals, can be contaminated with an alcohol. And yet, if we accept the Chinese definition of our former strength as the enslavement of alcohol, we can no longer resist this enslavement. For it appears to come free from all the materialistic trust with which the tasks of the general of our society are set. When we were driven, we were withdrawn from a material basis of life, which when looked upon at close quarters made us inevitably soiled. We first had to treat materialism as a disease of society before we could free ourselves of the disease of alcoholism and we would be free of the social ills that had made us alcoholics. For us, perhaps more than for any other people, our material struggles and ambitions, our false pride, our self-centeredness, and our jealousy died hard. And so, in a sense, we only eat death to the so-called enslavement of alcohol. For most human beings who have never suffered as a people, as those who have recovered from the disease of alcoholism, live lives with no purpose and with no patterns that they can discern. And if you ever are provided with an opportunity to change these patterns, at the time of our death, we are a little different than in the days of our living. For if you can see a few explosions in death, such as the deliverance from alcohol, to change our pattern to liberate us from the materialistic snares in which we were imprisoned. For when we accepted our weakness and ceased nurturing when we became free, we need to have the courage to deal with our weakness. We need to have the courage to realize in place of the illusory one from which we have been delivered. We need to use alcohol as an escape. I'm not the only people of our afraid life. Hustling to the world, fleeing from it into loneliness, turning desperately to run from the society that made it socially ill. Millions of human beings who are not alcoholics are living today in a literary world, nurturing the basic anxieties and insecurities of their human existence, rather than face themselves with courage and humility. Most of us who are not alcoholics have our own brand of escape whiskey, even though it hasn't an alcoholic content. For these people, we can only secure no magic potions, no chemical formula, no powerful drug. If the only thing we need to do is we are asked, how to deal with the same fuel of humility, honesty, devotion, and love, which indeed are the heart of our 12 steps. The next thing is a paradoxical statement of human society which has a special application for AA. For the very this statement lies the basic significance of our convening here together these last 3 days. And that statement is the same that a chain is as strong as a group of slaves. We accept the connotation of this expression that the material strength means it has no influence. And the paradox of this statement as applied to our way is that in truth our machine is as strong as a weakest link. For the only chain of the way grows in strength to the extent that we are able to reach the weakness our still-suffering alcoholic brothers and sisters, and it is in this paradoxical statement
that the assurance of the survival of our society was. Some civilizations of the past have generally emerged under the influence of the thought of a generation of strong leaders and of strong people. And these civilizations collapse when the preceding generation lost everything to you. And these civilizations began to wallow in the physical comfort of a materialistic age. Just when the preceding generation of many of these civilizations weakened and the strength of them was lost, these civilizations crumbled.